Intel probe that took 295 actions against black groups, black militancy seemed stubbornly resistant to destruction. A secret FBI report to President Nixon in 1970 said, "A recent poll indicates that approximately 25% of the black population has a great respect for the Black Panther Party, including 43% of blacks under 21 years of age." Was there fear that blacks would turn their attention from the controllable field of voting to the more dangerous arena of wealth and poverty, of class conflict? In 1966, 70 poor black people in Greenville, Mississippi, occupied an unused Air Force barracks until they were evicted by the military. A local woman, Mrs. Unita Blackwell, said, "I feel that the federal government have proven that it don't care about poor people. Everything that we have asked for through these years had been handed down on paper. It's never been a reality. We, the poor people of Mississippi, is tired. We're tired of it, so we're going to build for ourselves because we don't have a government that represents us." Out of the 1967 riots in Detroit came an organization devoted to organizing black workers for revolutionary change. This was the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which lasted until 1971 and influenced thousands of black workers in Detroit during its period of activity. The new emphasis was more dangerous than civil rights because it created the possibility of blacks and whites uniting on the issue of class exploitation. Back in November 1963, A. Philip Randolph had spoken to an AFL-CIO convention about the civil rights movement and foreseen its direction. The Negroes' protest today is but the first rumbling of the underclass. As the Negro has taken to the streets, so will the unemployed of all races take to the streets. Attempts began to do with blacks what had been done historically with whites, to lure a small number into the system with economic enticements. There was talk of black capitalism. Leaders of the NAACP and CORE were invited to the White House. James Farmer of CORE, a former freedom writer and militant, was given a job in President Nixon's administration. Floyd McKissick of CORE received a $14 million government loan to build a housing development in North Carolina. Lyndon Johnson had given jobs to some blacks through the Office of Economic Opportunity. Nixon set up an Office of Minority Business Enterprise. Chase Manhattan Bank and the Rockefeller family, controllers of Chase, took a special interest in developing black capitalism. The Rockefellers had always been financial patrons of the Urban League and a strong influence in black education through their support of Negro colleges in the South. David Rockefeller tried to persuade his fellow capitalists that while helping black businessmen with money might not be fruitful in the short run, it was necessary to shape an environment in which the business can continue earning a profit 4 or 5 or 10 years from now. With all of this, black business remained infinitesimally small. The largest black corporation, Motown Industries, had sales in 1974 of $45 million, while Exxon Corporation had sales of $42 billion. The total receipts of black-owned firms accounted for 0.3% of all business income. There was a small amount of change and a lot of publicity. There were more black faces in the newspapers and on television, creating an impression of change and siphoning off into the mainstream a small but significant number of black leaders. Some new black voices spoke against this. Robert Allen, Black Awakening in Capitalist America, wrote, "If the community as a whole is to benefit, then the community as a whole must be organized to manage collectively its internal economy and its business relations with white America. Black business firms must be treated and operated as social property belonging to the general black community, not as the private property of individual or limited groups of individuals. This necessitates the dismantling of capitalist property relations in the black community and their replacement with a planned communal economy." A black woman, Patricia Robinson, in a pamphlet distributed in Boston in 1970, poor black woman, tied male supremacy to capitalism, and said the black woman allies herself with the have-nots in the wider world and their revolutionary struggles. She said the poor black woman did not in the past question the social and economic system, but now she must, and in fact, she has begun to question aggressive male domination and the class society which enforces it, capitalism. Another black woman, Margaret Wright, said she was not fighting for equality with men if it meant equality in the world of killing, the world of competition. I don't want to compete on no damned exploitative level. I don't want to exploit nobody. I want the right to be black and me. The system was working hard by the late 60s and early 70s to contain the frightening explosiveness of the black upsurge. Blacks were voting in large numbers in the South, and in the 1968 Democratic Convention, three blacks were admitted into the Mississippi delegation. By 1977, more than 2,000 blacks held office in 11 southern states. In 1965, the number was 72. There were 2 congressmen, 11 state senators, 95 state representatives, 267 county commissioners, 76 mayors, 824 city council members, 18 sheriffs or chiefs of police, 508 school board members. It was a dramatic advance. But blacks, with 20% of the South's population, still held less than 3% of the elective offices. A New York Times reporter analyzing the new situation in 1977 pointed out that even where blacks held important city offices, whites almost always retain economic power. After Maynard Jackson, a black, became mayor of Atlanta, the white business establishment continued to exert its influence. Those blacks in the South who could afford to go to downtown restaurants and hotels were no longer barred because of their race. More blacks could go to colleges and universities, to law schools and medical schools. Northern cities were busing children back and forth in an attempt to create racially mixed schools, despite the racial segregation in housing. None of this, however, was halting what Francis Piven and Richard Cloward, poor people's movements, called the destruction of the black lower class, the unemployment, the deterioration of the ghetto, the rising crime, drug addiction, violence. In the summer of 1977, the Department of Labor reported that the rate of unemployment among black youths was 34.8%. A small new black middle class of blacks had been created, and it raised the overall statistics for black income. But there was a great disparity between the newly risen middle class black and the poor left behind. Despite the new opportunities for a small number of blacks, the median black family income of 1977 was only about 60% that of whites. Blacks were twice as likely to die of diabetes, 7 times as likely to be victims of homicidal violence rising out of the poverty and despair of the ghetto. A New York Times report in early 1978 said, "The places that experienced urban riots in the 1960s have, with a few exceptions, changed little, and the conditions of poverty have spread in most cities." Statistics did not tell the whole story. Racism, always a national fact, not just a southern one, emerged in northern cities as the federal government made concessions to poor blacks in a way that pitted them against poor whites for resources made scarce by the system. Blacks, freed from slavery to take their place under capitalism, had long been forced into conflict with whites for scarce jobs. Now, with desegregation in housing, blacks tried to move into neighborhoods where whites themselves poor, crowded, troubled, could find in them a target for their anger. In the Boston Globe, November 1977, "A Hispanic family of 6 fled their apartment in the Seven Hill section of Dorchester yesterday after a week of repeated stonings and window smashings by a group of white youths in what appears to have been racially motivated attacks," police say. In Boston, the busing of black children to white schools and whites to black schools set off a wave of white neighborhood violence. The use of busing to integrate schools, sponsored by the government and the courts in response to the black movement, was an ingenious concession to protest. It had the effect of pushing poor whites and poor blacks into competition for the miserable, inadequate schools which the system provided for all the poor. Was the black population hemmed into the ghetto, divided by the growth of a middle class, decimated by poverty, attacked by the government, driven into conflict with whites, under control? Surely in the mid-70s there was no great black movement underway. Yet a new black consciousness had been born and was still alive. Also, whites and blacks were crossing racial lines in the South to unite as a class against employers. In 1971, 2,000 woodworkers in Mississippi, black and white, joined together to protest a new method of measuring wood that led to lower wages. In the textile mills of J.P. Stevens, where 44,000 workers were employed in 85 plants, mostly in the South, blacks and whites were working together in union activity. In Tifton, Georgia, and Milledgeville, Georgia, in 1977, blacks and whites served together on the union committees of their plants. Would a new black movement go beyond the limits of the civil rights actions of the 60s, beyond the spontaneous urban riots of the 70s, beyond separatism to a coalition of white and black in a historic new alliance? There was no way of knowing this in 1978. In 1978, 6 million black people were unemployed. As Langston Hughes said, "What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up or does it explode?" If it did explode, as it had in the past, it would come with a certain inevitability, out of the conditions of black life in America. And yet, because no one knew when, it would come as a surprise. Chapter 18, The Impossible Victory, Vietnam. From 1964 to 1972, the wealthiest and most powerful nation in the history of the world made a maximum military effort, with everything short of atomic bombs, to defeat a nationalist revolutionary movement in a tiny peasant country, and failed. When the United States fought in Vietnam, it was organized modern technology versus organized human beings, and the human beings won. In the course of that war, there developed in the United States the greatest anti-war movement the nation had ever experienced, a movement that played a critical part in bringing the war to an end. It was another startling fact of the 60s. In the fall of 1945, Japan, defeated, was forced to leave Indochina, the former French colony it had occupied at the start of the war. In the meantime, a revolutionary movement had grown there, determined to end colonial control and to achieve a new life for the peasants of Indochina. Led by a communist named Ho Chi Minh, the revolutionists fought against the Japanese, and when they were gone, held a spectacular celebration in Hanoi in late 1945, with 1 million people in the streets, and issued a Declaration of Independence. It borrowed from the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen in the French Revolution, and from the American Declaration of Independence, and began, "All men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Just as the Americans in 1776 had listed their grievances against the English king, the Vietnamese listed their complaints against French rule. "They have enforced inhuman laws. They have built more prisons than schools. They have mercilessly slain our patriots. They have drowned uprisings in rivers of blood. They have fettered public opinion. They have robbed us of our rice fields, our mines, our forests, and our raw materials. They have invented numerous unjustifiable taxes and reduced our people, especially our peasantry, to a state of extreme poverty. From the end of last year to the beginning of this year, more than 2 million of our fellow citizens died of starvation. The whole Vietnamese people, animated by a common purpose, are determined to fight to the bitter end against any attempt by the French colonialists to reconquer their country. The U.S. Defense Department's study of the Vietnam War, intended to be top secret, but released to the public by Daniel Ellsberg and Anthony Russo in the famous Pentagon Papers case, described Ho Chi Minh's work. Ho had built the Viet Minh into the only Vietnam-wide political organization capable of effective resistance to either the Japanese or the French. He was the only Vietnamese wartime leader with a national following, and he assured himself wider fealty among the Vietnamese people when in August and September 1945, he overthrew the Japanese, established the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, and staged receptions for incoming Allied occupation forces. For a few weeks in September 1945, Vietnam was, for the first and only time in its modern history, free of foreign domination and united from north to south under Ho Chi Minh. The Western powers were already at work to change this. England occupied the southern part of Indochina and then turned it back to the French. Nationalist China, this was under Chiang Kai-shek before the Communist Revolution, occupied the northern part of Indochina, and the United States persuaded it to turn that back to the French. As Ho Chi Minh told an American journalist, "We apparently stand quite alone. We shall have to depend on ourselves." Between October 1945 and February 1946, Ho Chi Minh wrote 8 letters to President Truman, reminding him of the self-determination promises of the Atlantic Charter. One of the letters was sent both to Truman and to the United Nations. "I wish to invite attention of Your Excellency, for strictly humanitarian reasons, to following matter. 2 million Vietnamese died of starvation during winter of 1944 and spring 1945. Because of starvation policy of French, who seized and stored until it rotted all available rice. 3/4 of cultivated land was flooded in the summer of 1945, which was followed by a severe drought. Of normal harvest, 5/6 was lost. Many people are starving. Unless great world powers and international relief organizations bring us immediate assistance, we face imminent catastrophe." Truman never replied. In October of 1946, the French bombarded Haiphong, a port in northern Vietnam, and there began the 8-year war between the Viet Minh movement and the French over who would rule Vietnam. After the Communist victory in China in 1949 and the Korean War the following year, the United States began giving large amounts of military aid to the French. By 1954, the United States had given 300,000 small arms and machine guns, enough to equip the entire French army in Indochina, and $1 billion. Altogether, the U.S. was financing 80% of the French war effort. Why was the United States doing this? To the public, the word was that the United States was helping to stop communism in Asia. But there was not much public discussion. In the secret memoranda of the National Security Council, which advised the president on foreign policy, there was talk in 1950 of what came to be known as the domino theory, that like a row of dominoes, if one country fell to communism, the next one would do the same, and so on. It was important, therefore, to keep the first one from falling. A secret memo of the National Security Council in June 1952 also pointed to the chain of U.S. military bases along the coast of China, the Philippines, Taiwan, Japan, South Korea. Communist control of all of Southeast Asia would render the U.S. position in the Pacific offshore island chain precarious and would seriously jeopardize fundamental U.S. security interests in the Far East. And Southeast Asia, especially Malaya and Indonesia, is the principal world source of natural rubber and tin, and a producer of petroleum and other strategically important commodities. It was also noted that Japan depended on the rice of Southeast Asia, and communist victory there would make it extremely difficult to prevent Japan's eventual accommodation to communism. In 1953, a congressional study mission reported, "The area of Indochina is immensely wealthy in rice, rubber, coal, and iron ore. Its position makes it a strategic key to the rest of Southeast Asia." That year, a State Department memorandum said that the French were losing the war in Indochina, had failed to win a sufficient native support, feared that a negotiated settlement would mean the eventual loss to communism not only of Indochina, but of the whole of Southeast Asia, and concluded, "If the French actually decided to withdraw, the U.S. would have to consider most seriously whether to take over in this area." In 1954, the French, having been unable to win Vietnamese popular support, which was overwhelmingly behind Ho Chi Minh and the revolutionary movement, had to withdraw. An international assemblage at Geneva presided over the peace agreement between the French and the Viet Minh. It was agreed that the French would temporarily withdraw into the southern part of Vietnam, that the Viet Minh would remain in the north, and that an election would take place in 2 years in a unified Vietnam to enable the Vietnamese to choose their own government. The United States moved quickly to prevent the unification and to establish South Vietnam as an American sphere. It set up in Saigon, as head of the government, a former Vietnamese official named Ngo Dinh Diem, who had recently been living in New Jersey, and encouraged him not to hold the scheduled elections for unification. A memo in early 1954 of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said that intelligence estimates showed a settlement based on free elections would be attended by almost certain loss of the associated states, Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, the three parts of Indochina created by the Geneva Conference, to communist control. Diem again and again blocked the elections requested by the Viet Minh, and with American money and arms, his government became more and more firmly established. As the Pentagon Papers put it, South Vietnam was essentially the creation of the United States. The Diem regime became increasingly unpopular. Diem was a Catholic, and most Vietnamese were Buddhists. Diem was close to the landlords, and this was a country of peasants. His pretenses at land reform left things basically as they were. He replaced locally selected provincial chiefs with his own men, appointed in Saigon. By 1962, 88% of these provincial chiefs were military men. Diem imprisoned more and more Vietnamese who criticized the regime for corruption, for lack of reform. Opposition grew quickly in the countryside, where Diem's apparatus could not reach well, and around 1958, guerrilla activities began against the regime. The communist regime in Hanoi gave aid, encouragement, and sent people south, most of them southerners who had gone north after the Geneva Accords, to support the guerrilla movement. In 1960, the National Liberation Front was formed in the south. It united the various strands of opposition to the regime. Its strength came from South Vietnamese peasants, who saw it as a way of changing their daily lives. A U.S. government analyst named Douglas Pike, in his book, Viet Cong, based on interviews with rebels and captured documents, tried to give a realistic assessment of what the United States faced. In the 2,561 villages of South Vietnam, The National Liberation Front created a host of nationwide socio-political organizations in a country where mass organizations were virtually non-existent. Aside from the NLF, there had never been a truly mass-based political party in South Vietnam. Pike wrote, "The communists have brought to the villages of South Vietnam significant social change and have done so largely by means of the communication process. That is, they were organizers much more than they were warriors. What struck me most forcibly about the NLF was its totality as a social revolution first and as a war second." Pike was impressed with the mass involvement of the peasants in the movement. The rural Vietnamese was not regarded simply as a pawn in a power struggle, but as the active element in the thrust. He was the thrust. Pike wrote, "The purpose of this vast organizational effort was to restructure the social order of the village and train the villages to control themselves. This was the NLF's one undeviating thrust from the start. Not the killing of Arvin, Saigon, soldiers, not the occupation of real estate, not the preparation for some great pitched battle, but organization in depth of the rural population through the instrument of self-control." Pike estimated that the NLF membership by early 1962 stood at around 300,000. The Pentagon Papers said of this period, "Only the Viet Cong had any real support and influence on a broad base in the countryside." When Kennedy took office in early 1961, he continued the policies of Truman and Eisenhower in Southeast Asia. Almost immediately, he approved a secret plan for various military actions in Vietnam and Laos, including the dispatch of agents to North Vietnam to engage in sabotage and light harassment, according to the Pentagon Papers. Back in 1956, he had spoken of the amazing success of President Diem, and said of Diem's Vietnam, "Her political liberty is an inspiration." One day in June 1963, a Buddhist monk sat down in the public square in Saigon and set himself afire. More Buddhist monks began committing suicide by fire to dramatize their opposition to the Diem regime. Diem's police raided the Buddhist pagodas and temples, wounded 30 monks, arrested 1,400 people, and closed down the pagodas. There were demonstrations in the city. The police fired, killing 9 people. Then, in Hue, the ancient capital, 10,000 demonstrated in protest. Under the Geneva Accords, the United States was permitted to have 685 military advisors in southern Vietnam. Eisenhower secretly sent several thousand. Under Kennedy, the figure rose to 16,000, and some of them began to take part in combat operations. Diem was losing. Most of the South Vietnam countryside was now controlled by local villagers organized by the NLF. Diem was becoming an embarrassment, an obstacle to effective control over Vietnam. Some Vietnamese generals began plotting to overthrow his regime. Staying in touch with a CIA man named Lucien Conane. Conane met secretly with American Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge, who was enthusiastically for the coup. Lodge reported to Kennedy's assistant, McGeorge Bundy, on October 25th, Pentagon Papers, "I have personally approved each meeting between General Tran Van Don and Conane, who has carried out my orders in each instance explicitly." Kennedy seemed hesitant, but no move was made to warn Diem. Indeed, just before the coup, and just after he had been in touch through Conane with the plotters, Lodge spent a weekend with Diem at a seaside resort. When, on November 1, 1963, the generals attacked the presidential palace, Diem phoned Ambassador Lodge, and the conversation went as follows. Diem, "Some units have made a rebellion, and I want to know what is the attitude of the United States." Lodge, I do not feel well enough informed to be able to tell you. I have heard the shooting, but am not acquainted with all of the facts. Also, it is 4:30 a.m. in Washington, and the U.S. government cannot possibly have a view. DM, but you must have some general ideas. Lodge told DM to phone him if he could do anything for his physical safety. That was the last conversation any American had with DM. He fled the palace, but he and his brother were apprehended by the plotters, taken out in a truck, and executed. Earlier in 1963, Kennedy's Undersecretary of State, U. Alexis Johnson, was speaking before the Economic Club of Detroit. What is the attraction that Southeast Asia has exerted for centuries on the great powers flanking it on all sides? Why is it desirable and why is it important? First, it provides a lush climate, fertile soil, rich natural resources, a relatively sparse population in most areas, and room to expand. The countries of Southeast Asia produce rich exportable surpluses such as rice, rubber, teak, corn, tin, spices, oil, and many others. This is not the language that was used by President Kennedy in his explanations to the American public. He talked of communism and freedom. In a news conference, February 14, 1962, he said, "Yes, as you know, the U.S. for more than a decade has been assisting the government, the people of Vietnam, to maintain their independence." 3 weeks after the execution of Diem, Kennedy himself was assassinated, and his vice president, Lyndon Johnson, took office. The generals who succeeded Diem could not suppress the National Liberation Front. Again and again, American leaders expressed their bewilderment at the popularity of the NLF, at the high morale of its soldiers. The Pentagon historians wrote that when Eisenhower met with President-elect Kennedy in January 1961, he wondered aloud why, in interventions of this kind, we always seemed to find that the morale of the communist forces was better than that of the democratic forces. And General Maxwell Taylor reported in late 1964, "The ability of the Viet Cong continuously to rebuild their units and to make good their losses is one of the mysteries of the guerrilla war. Not only do the Viet Cong units have the recuperative powers of the Phoenix, but they have an amazing ability to maintain morale. Only in rare cases have we found evidence of bad morale among Viet Cong prisoners or recorded in captured Viet Cong documents." In early 1964, President Johnson used a murky set of events in the Gulf of Tonkin, off the coast of North Vietnam, to launch full-scale war on Vietnam. Johnson and Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara told the American public there was an attack by North Vietnamese torpedo boats on American destroyers. "While on routine patrol in international waters," McNamara said, "the U.S. destroyer Maddox underwent an unprovoked attack." It later turned out that the Gulf of Tonkin episode was a fake, that the highest American officials had lied to the public, just as they had in the invasion of Cuba under Kennedy. In fact, the CIA had engaged in a secret operation attacking North Vietnamese coastal installations, so if there had been an attack, it would not have been unprovoked. It was not a routine patrol, because the Maddox was on a special electronic spying mission. And it was not in international waters, but in Vietnamese territorial waters. It turned out that no torpedoes were fired at the Maddox, as McNamara said. Another reported attack on another destroyer 2 nights later, which Johnson called open aggression on the high seas, seems also to have been an invention. At the time of the incident, Secretary of State Rusk was questioned on NBC television. Reporter, "What explanation, then, can you come up with for this unprovoked attack?" Rusk, "Well, I haven't been able, quite frankly, to come to a fully satisfactory explanation. There is a great gulf of understanding between that world and our world, ideological in character. They see what we think of as the real world in wholly different terms. Their very processes of logic are different, so that it's very difficult to enter into each other's minds across that great ideological gulf. The Tonkin attack brought a congressional resolution passed unanimously in the House and with only two dissenting votes in the Senate, giving Johnson the power to take military action as he saw fit in Southeast Asia. 2 months before the Gulf of Tonkin incident, U.S. government leaders met in Honolulu and discussed such a resolution. Rusk said in this meeting, according to the Pentagon Papers, that public opinion on our Southeast Asia policy was badly divided in the United States at the moment, and that therefore the president needed an affirmation of support. The Tonkin resolution gave the president the power to initiate hostilities without the declaration of war by Congress that the Constitution required. The Supreme Court, supposed to be the watchdog of the Constitution, was asked by a number of petitioners in the course of the Vietnam War to declare the war unconstitutional. Again and again, it refused even to consider the issue. Immediately after the Tonkin affair, American warplanes began bombarding North Vietnam. During 1965, over 200,000 American soldiers were sent to South Vietnam, and in 1966, 200,000 more. By early 1968, there were more than 500,000 American troops there, and the U.S. Air Force was dropping bombs at a rate unequaled in history. Tiny glimmerings of the massive human suffering under this bombardment came to the outside world. On June 5, 1965, the New York Times carried a dispatch from Saigon. As the communists withdrew from Quang Nai last Monday, United States jet bombers pounded the hills into which they were headed. Many Vietnamese, one estimate is as high as 500, were killed by the strikes. The American contention is that they were Viet Cong soldiers, but 3 out of 4 patients seeking treatment in a Vietnamese hospital afterward for burns from napalm or jellied gasoline were village women. On September 6th, another press dispatch from Saigon. In Bien Ho province south of Saigon on August 15th, United States aircraft accidentally bombed a Buddhist pagoda and a Catholic church. It was the third time their pagoda had been bombed in 1965. A temple of the Chow Dai religious sect in the same area had been bombed twice this year. In another Delta province, there is a woman who has both arms burned off by napalm, and her eyelids so badly burned that she cannot close them. When it is time for her to sleep, her family puts a blanket over her head. The woman had 2 of her children killed in the airstrike that maimed her. Few Americans appreciate what their nation is doing to South Vietnam with air power. Innocent civilians are dying every day in South Vietnam. Large areas of South Vietnam were declared free fire zones, which meant that all persons remaining within them, civilians, old people, children, were considered an enemy, and bombs were dropped at will. Villages suspected of harboring Viet Cong were subject to search and destroy missions. Men of military age in the villages were killed. The homes were burned. The women, children, and old people were sent off to refugee camps. Jonathan Schell, in his book, The Village of Ben Suc, describes such an operation. A village surrounded, attacked, a man riding on a bicycle shot down. 3 people picnicking by the river shot to death, the houses destroyed, the women, children, old people herded together, taken away from their ancestral homes. The CIA in Vietnam, in a program called Operation Phoenix, secretly, without trial, executed at least 20,000 civilians in South Vietnam who were suspected of being members of the Communist Underground. A pro-administration analyst wrote in the journal Foreign Affairs in January 1975, "Although the Phoenix program did undoubtedly kill or incarcerate many innocent civilians, it did also eliminate many members of the communist infrastructure." After the war, the release of records of the International Red Cross showed that in South Vietnamese prison camps, where at the height of the war 65,000 to 70,000 people were held and often beaten and tortured, American advisors observed and sometimes participated. The Red Cross observers found continuing systematic brutality at the two principal Vietnamese POW camps, at Phu Quoc, at Khi Non, where American advisors were stationed. By the end of the Vietnam War, 7 million tons of bombs had been dropped on Vietnam, more than twice the total bombs dropped on Europe and Asia in World War II, and almost one 500-pound bomb for every human being in Vietnam. It was estimated that there were 20 million bomb craters in the country. In addition, poisonous sprays were dropped by planes to destroy trees and any kind of growth. An area the size of the state of Massachusetts was covered with such poison. Vietnamese mothers reported birth defects in their children. Yale biologists, using the same poison, 2,4,5-T, on mice, reported defective mice born and said they had no reason to believe the effect on humans was different. On March 16, 1968, a company of American soldiers went into the hamlet of My Lai 4 in Quang Nai province. They rounded up the inhabitants, including old people and women with infants in their arms. These people were ordered into a ditch where they were methodically shot to death by American soldiers. The testimony of James Dersey, a rifleman, at the later trial of Lieutenant William Calley, was reported in the New York Times. Lieutenant Calley and a weeping rifleman named Paul D. Meadlow, the same soldier who had fed candy to the children before shooting them, pushed the prisoners into the ditch. There was an order to shoot by Lieutenant Calley. I can't remember the exact words. It was something like, "Start firing." Meadlow turned to me and said, "Shoot, why don't you shoot?" He was crying. I said, "I can't, I won't." Then Lieutenant Calley and Meadlow pointed their rifles into the ditch and fired. People were diving on top of each other. Mothers were trying to protect their children. Journalist Seymour Hersh, in his book My Lai 4, writes, "When Army investigators reached the barren area in November 1969, in connection with the My Lai probe in the United States, they found mass graves at three sites, as well as a ditch full of bodies. It was estimated that between 450 and 500 people, most of them women, children, and old men, had been slain and buried there." The Army tried to cover up what happened, but a letter began circulating from a GI named Ron Ridenhour, who had heard about the massacre. There were photos taken of the killing by an Army photographer, Ronald Haberl. Seymour Hersh, then working for an anti-war news agency in Southeast Asia called Dispatch News Service, wrote about it. The story of the massacre had appeared in May 1968 in two French publications, one called Sud Vietnam en Lutte, and another published by the North Vietnamese delegation to the peace talks in Paris. But the American press did not pay any attention. Several of the officers in the My Lai massacre were put on trial, but only Lieutenant William Calley was found guilty. He was sentenced to life imprisonment, but his sentence was reduced twice. He served 3 years. Nixon ordered that he be under house arrest rather than a regular prison, and then was paroled. Thousands of Americans came to his defense. Part of it was in patriotic justification of his action as necessary against the communists. Part of it seems to have been a feeling that he was unjustly singled out in a war with many similar atrocities. Colonel Orrin Henderson, who had been charged with covering up the My Lai killings, told reporters in early 1971, "Every unit of brigade size has its My Lai hidden someplace." Indeed, My Lai was unique only in its details. Hersh reported a letter sent by a GI to his family and published in a local newspaper. "Dear Mom and Dad, Today we went on a mission, and I am not very proud of myself, my friends, or my country. We burned every hut in sight. It was a small, rural network of villages, and the people were incredibly poor. My unit burned and plundered their meager possessions. Let me try to explain the situation to you. The huts here are thatched palm leaves. Each one has a dried mud bunker inside. These bunkers are to protect the families, kind of like air raid shelters. My unit commanders, however, chose to think that these bunkers are offensive. So every hut we find that has a bunker, we are ordered to burn to the ground. When the 10 helicopters landed this morning in the midst of these huts, and 6 men jumped out of each chopper, we were firing the moment we hit the ground. We fired into all the huts we could. It is then that we burned these huts. Everyone is crying, begging, and praying that we don't separate them and take their husbands and fathers, sons and grandfathers. The women wail and moan. Then they watch in terror as we burn their homes, personal possessions, and food. Yes, we burn all rice and shoot all livestock. The more unpopular became the Saigon government, the more desperate the military effort became to make up for this. A secret congressional report of late 1967 said the Viet Cong were distributing about 5 times more land to the peasants than the South Vietnamese government, whose land distribution program had come to a virtual standstill. The report said, "The Viet Cong have eliminated landlord domination and reallocated lands owned by absentee landlords and the GVN, Government of Vietnam, to the landless and others who cooperate with Viet Cong authorities." The unpopularity of the Saigon government explains the success of the National Liberation Front in infiltrating Saigon and other government-held towns in early 1968, without the people there warning the government. The NLF thus launched a surprise offensive. It was the time of Tet, their New Year holiday, that carried them into the heart of Saigon, immobilized Tan Son Nhut airfield, even occupied the American embassy briefly. The offensive was beaten back, but it demonstrated that all the enormous firepower delivered in Vietnam by the United States had not destroyed the NLF, its morale, its popular support, its will to fight. It caused a reassessment in the American government, more doubts among the American people. The massacre at My Lai by a company of ordinary soldiers was a small event compared with the plans of high-level military and civilian leaders to visit massive destruction on the civilian population of Vietnam. Assistant Secretary of Defense John McNaughton, in early 1966, seeing that large-scale bombing of North Vietnam villages was not producing the desired result, suggested a different strategy. The airstrikes on villages, he said, would create a counterproductive wave of revulsion abroad and at home. He suggested instead, destruction of locks and dams, however, if handled right, might offer promise. It should be studied. Such destruction doesn't kill or drown people. By shallow flooding the rice, it leads after a time to widespread starvation, more than 1 million. Unless food is provided, which we could offer to do at the conference table. The heavy bombings were intended to destroy the will of ordinary Vietnamese to resist, as in the bombings of German and Japanese population centers in World War II, despite President Johnson's public insistence that only military targets were being bombed. The government was using language like, "one more turn of the screw," to describe bombing. The CIA at one point in 1966 recommended a bombing program of greater intensity, according to the Pentagon Papers, directed against, in the CIA's words, the will of the regime as a target system. Meanwhile, just across the border of Vietnam in a neighboring country, Laos, where a right-wing government installed by the CIA faced a rebellion, one of the most beautiful areas in the world, the Plain of Jars, was being destroyed by bombing. This was not reported by the government or the press, but an American who lived in Laos, Fred Branfman, told the story in his book Voices from the Plain of Jars. Over 25,000 attack sorties were flown against the Plain of Jars from May 1964 through September 1969. Over 75,000 tons of bombs were dropped on it. On the ground, thousands were killed and wounded, tens of thousands driven underground, and the entire above-ground society leveled. Branfman, who spoke the Laotian language and lived in a village with a Laotian family, interviewed hundreds of refugees from the bombing who poured into the capital city of Vientiane. He recorded their statements and preserved their drawings. A 26-year-old nurse from Xiankang told of her life in the village. "I was at one with the earth, the air, the upland fields, the paddy and the seedbeds of my village. Each day and night in the light of the moon, I and my friends from the village would wander, calling out and singing through forest and field amidst the cries of the birds. During the harvesting and planting season, we would sweat and labor together under the sun and the rain, contending with poverty and miserable conditions, continuing the farmer's life which has been the profession of our ancestors. But in 1964 and 1965, I could feel the trembling of the earth and the shock from the sounds of arms exploding around my village. I began to hear the noise of airplanes circling about in the heavens. One of them would stick its head down and, plunging earthward, loose a loud roar, shocking the earth as light and smoke covered everything so that one could not see anything at all. Each day we would exchange news with the neighboring villagers of the bombings that had occurred, the damaged houses, the injured and the dead. The holes, the holes! During that time we needed holes to save our lives. We who were young took our sweat and our strength, which should have been spent raising food in the rice fields and forests, to sustain our lives, and squandered it, digging holes to protect ourselves. One young woman explained why the revolutionary movement in Laos, the Neo-Lao, attracted her and so many of her friends. "As a young girl, I had found that the past had not been very good, for men had mistreated and made fun of women as the weaker sex. But after the Neo-Lao party began to administer the region, it became very different. Under the Neo-Lao, things changed psychologically, such as their teaching that women should be as brave as men. For example, although I had gone to school before, my elders advised me not to. They had said that it would not be useful for me as I could not hope to be a high-ranking official after graduation, that only the children of the elite or rich could expect that. But the Neo-Lao said that the women should have the same education as men, and they gave us equal privileges and did not allow anyone to make fun of us. And the old associations were changed into new ones. For example, most of the new teachers and doctors trained were women, and they changed the lives of the very poor, for they shared the land of those who had many rice fields with those who had none." A 17-year-old boy told about the Pathet Lao Revolutionary Army coming to his village. "Some people were afraid, mostly those with money. They offered cows to the Pathet Lao soldiers to eat, but the soldiers refused to take them. If they did take them, they paid a suitable price. The truth is that they led the people not to be afraid of anything. Then they organized the election of village and canton chief, and the people were the ones who chose them. Desperation led the CIA to enlist the Hmong tribesmen in military campaigns, which led to the deaths of thousands of Hmong. This was accompanied by secrecy and lying, as was so much of what happened in Laos. In September 1973, a former government official in Laos, Jerome Doolittle, wrote in the New York Times, "The Pentagon's most recent lies about bombing Cambodia bring back a question that often occurred to me when I was press attaché at the American Embassy in Vientiane, Laos. Why did we bother to lie? When I first arrived in Laos, I was instructed to answer all press questions about our massive and merciless bombing campaign in that tiny country with, 'At the request of the Royal Laotian government, The United States is conducting unarmed reconnaissance flights accompanied by armed escorts who have the right to return if fired upon. This was a lie. Every reporter to whom I told it knew it was a lie. Hanoi knew it was a lie. The International Control Commission knew it was a lie. Every interested congressman and newspaper reader knew it was a lie. After all, the lies did serve to keep something from somebody, and the somebody was us. By early 1968, the cruelty of the war began touching the conscience of many Americans. For many others, the problem was that the United States was unable to win the war, while 40,000 American soldiers were dead by this time, 250,000 wounded, with no end in sight. The Vietnam casualties were many times this number. Lyndon Johnson had escalated a brutal war and failed to win it. His popularity was at an all-time low. He could not appear publicly without a demonstration against him in the war. The chant, LBJ, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today, was heard in demonstrations throughout the country. In the spring of 1968, Johnson announced he would not run again for president, and that negotiations for peace would begin with the Vietnamese in Paris. In the fall of 1968, Richard Nixon, pledging that he would get the United States out of Vietnam, was elected president. He began to withdraw troops. By February 1972, less than 150,000 were left. But the bombing continued. Nixon's policy was Vietnamization. The Saigon government, with Vietnamese ground troops, using American money and air power, would carry on the war. Nixon was not ending the war. He was ending the most unpopular aspect of it, the involvement of American soldiers on the soil of a faraway country. In the spring of 1970, Nixon and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger launched an invasion of Cambodia, after a long bombardment that the government never disclosed to the public. The invasion not only led to an outcry of protest in the United States, it was a military failure, and Congress resolved that Nixon could not use American troops in extending the war without congressional approval. The following year, without American troops, the United States supported a South Vietnamese invasion of Laos. This, too, failed. In 1971, 800,000 tons of bombs were dropped by the United States on Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam. Meantime, the Saigon military regime, headed by President Nguyen Van Thieu, the last of a long succession of Saigon chiefs of state, was keeping thousands of opponents in jail. Some of the first signs of opposition in the United States to the Vietnam War came out of the civil rights movement, perhaps because the experience of black people with the government led them to distrust any claim that it was fighting for freedom. On the very day that Lyndon Johnson was telling the nation in early August 1964 about the Gulf of Tonkin incident and announcing the bombing of North Vietnam, black and white activists were gathering near Philadelphia, Mississippi, at a memorial service for the three civil rights workers killed there that summer. One of the speakers pointed bitterly to Johnson's use of force in Asia, comparing it with the violence used against blacks in Mississippi. In mid-1965, in Macomb, Mississippi, young blacks who had just learned that a classmate of theirs was killed in Vietnam distributed a leaflet. No Mississippi Negroes should be fighting in Vietnam for the white man's freedom until all the Negro people are free in Mississippi. Negro boys should not honor the draft here in Mississippi. Mothers should encourage their sons not to go. No one has a right to ask us to risk our lives and kill other colored people in Santo Domingo and Vietnam so that the white American can get richer. When Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara visited Mississippi and praised Senator John Stennis, a prominent racist, as a man of genuine greatness, white and black students marched in protest, with placards saying, in memory of the burned children of Vietnam. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee declared in early 1966 that the United States is pursuing an aggressive policy in violation of international law and called for withdrawal from Vietnam. That summer, six members of SNCC were arrested for an invasion of an induction center in Atlanta. They were convicted and sentenced to several years in prison. Around the same time, Julian Bond, a SNCC activist who had just been elected to the Georgia House of Representatives,